Hello, dear listeners. This is a new episode of my podcast, Data Science Phil. And today I'm here with Bence Melikuti. He is a Hungarian mathematician who did his master's at ELTE University in Budapest and then went on to do a PhD at the famous University of Oxford in the UK. His PhD there was on biochemical reaction networks, so the mathematical modeling thereof. And so you can already see, Bence is a very accomplished person, I have to say. And also, he in Oxford, he met, he just told me, Philipp Meini, who one or the other listener might know. He is the author of the famous textbook on mathematical biology. So that I already found very interesting. And so why don't you? I will give now over now to
Okay,
Bence.
thank you, Philip, for having me here. My plan today is to talk to you about three interesting subjects, things that I find interesting, which have relatively little to do with my work. So these are three statistical problems. The idea is that I want to be able to estimate the number of things, just some things around us in the world, like everyday, really everyday problems.
Like, for example, the average height of a German citizen.
Perhaps, yes,
Yes,
not exactly. Something more, less trivial than that, let's say, and something you wouldn't think of. But I find it interesting to go around in the world, gather small bits of information, and try to infer something that is not obviously to be seen, right? So the three subjects I have today have some of them have fancy names. So one is the German tank problem. The second one is called the capture mark recapture technique. And the third one is called the Fermi problem. Okay, so let's start with the German tank problem.
Yes,
So
let's go there.
imagine we're in World War II. We are the Allied forces, and our goal is basically an intelligence task, which is to find a way to estimate how many tanks the Germans have, how many tanks they are producing in a given time interval, so over a month.
Which is, of course, important for the Allied forces, right?
Which is, of course, very important. It was especially an important issue just before the Normandy landing, trying to estimate what kind of forces are there to be expected.
I see.
This is important for military planning, of course, for planning battlefield, arrangements, on what amount of forces you need to amass, and so on. And so the question is, how do you estimate how many tanks the Germans are producing in a month, for instance? And of course,
Yes,
There
yeah.
are, there is a statistical way which we are going to talk about, and there is the standard way, which is to send out spies, or talk to the French
Right,
resistance
yeah.
and ask them how many they see on the streets
True.
in Normandy. And so one thing that is somehow given in engineering is that when you produce something, then you number them. So there is serial numbers on tanks, starting from zero and then always increasing, right? So what they found out is that it's not even something you need to find out. I mean, it's a given that if somebody produces tanks, then they will number the bodies of the tanks, so the chassis, the engines, the gearboxes, even the road wheels. And so a problem was, before the Normandy landing, how many German Panther tanks there were. So these Panther tanks had 32 road wheels, each of which were numbered by, I think, the mold form. So the mold form was had a number on it, so they could, by capturing these tanks, look at somehow the distribution of the numbers that you see.
I see,
And from estimating how many molds there are, they talked to American engineers who said from how many molds, how many wheels you can produce in a day or in a month. And from that, the statistical problem was whether you can estimate the number of wheels, and from the number of wheels, whether you can estimate the number of tanks. Okay, and so the mathematical or statistical, theorem or just piece of knowledge behind this is that if you draw numbers from the uniform random distribution, so let's say you draw k numbers on the zero, let's say zero, one interval, continuous, Yeah, so uniform random distribution, 0, 1 interval, you draw k numbers, and you look at the maximum of these k numbers, then the expectation of the maximum will be k divided by k plus 1. So you can imagine that you have the interval, and in expectation...
We're talking about the real numbers here, right?
Let's say the 0, 1 interval, yes, the real numbers. And the idea is that if you pick k numbers randomly in this interval, then they will be, so in average, they will divide this into k plus 1 equal length intervals.
Why is that?
You can just write it down. You have to write down integrals, I guess.
So we have like this, I will put that in the show notes, this interval, and we have infinitely many.
So Philip is just throwing the 0, 1 interval.
Yes.
And what I'm saying is that, okay, if you pick a number, okay, just pick one number.
For example, 0.5.
Well, you pick a random number, so you don't know whether it will be 0.5, but the point is that because it can be anywhere and it's uniformly distributed, on average, it will be 0.5.
Yeah, yeah.
If you pick two numbers, well, it's not so easy to see, but the point is that the smaller of the two will be, on average, 1/3, and the larger will be, on average, 2/3.
2/3, okay. Yeah.
If you pick k numbers, then on average, it will be, the largest one will be k over k plus 1.
K over k plus 1, makes sense, yeah.
Okay, so this is just a simple calculation. Yeah. And the idea is that this also applies if you have a discrete sequence of numbers, so the serial numbers of the tanks, so 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
To whatever, how many tanks there are. And what you do is you capture these tanks, or you just collect destroyed tanks on the battlefield because you overrun the Germans because you're progressing ahead, and then you capture the area.
Yeah.
And you look at the serial numbers. And the idea is that you look at the maximum of these serial numbers, that will divide your complete interval just like the randomly chosen numbers from a uniform distribution divide the interval. So the idea is that if you capture k tanks and you look at the chassis numbers of these k tanks, then the maximum number of what you see is related to n plus 1, so the total number of tanks plus 1, like k relates to k plus 1.
So let's imagine we captured k equals 2 tanks.
Yes.
Then
and the idea is that they...
And these have the serial numbers, let's say in the easiest case, 1 and 2.
I think that's just too easy for you to say, like it should be 60 and 103 or something.
60 and 103, okay. And
then the idea is that this 103 should divide this interval 2 to 3. I mean, so that to the left there are 2 units and to the right there is 1 unit.
But can't I immediately say that the Germans have at least a maximum of 103 tanks?
So that's a trivial thing to say, that they have at most 103, but we wanted to say something more advanced. And that is the idea that if the Germans made capital N tanks, and you capture 2, and the larger of these 2 is 103, then 103 divided by the total number of tanks N that the Germans made is the same as 3.
Yeah.
And so you just rearrange this and use what is called the moment method in statistics, method of moments of statistics.
Okay.
And you can compute an estimate for the total number of tanks.
For the total number of tanks, yeah.
For the total number of tanks, of course. And then, of course, you can make it more advanced. So, let's say you can look at the tanks you captured in a month, like all the history of the tanks you've captured until a given month, and then add into those which you captured in the next month and the next month. And if you estimate for every month, then you can kind of see the rate of production over 1 month.
I see, wow. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this actually made a big difference back then. So there is an example here. I hope I can find it quickly. It's actually on Wikipedia. So it's called the German tank problem. for very accurate numbers. Where is this? Okay, so the spies on the ground, so all the parties and contacts, estimated that the Germans were producing around 1,000 to 1,500 tanks in a month.
In a month, yeah.
The statistical estimate said that what we've just discussed, it said something like 240. So that's an order of like five or this magnitude difference. Yes. And then after the war, they looked it up in the German records, and it turned out that the German records said something like, instead of 246, it said 245 or something.
Wow, okay.
So it was like ridiculous, within 5% or 10% accuracy. So it is quite remarkable from that something so trivial, just simply that something is numbered in sequence, you can make very accurate estimates.
You mentioned this method of moments. Is it something like advanced or quote-unquote advanced, like, is it some estimation procedure like...
So that's one of the most... that is one of the most basic statistical estimation methods. It says that you take a random distribution, which is parameterized by one or two or whatever number of parameters. So like the exponential distribution is parameterized by mu, usually. The normal is distribution.
Yes, yes, yes. The normal by two, yeah. By
two,
the,
so
the standard mean deviation, yeah.
And the variance or standard deviation, yeah. And the idea is that you choose what we call moments of the distribution. So you have a sample, so you have n identically distributed independent samples from this distribution. And if the distribution has one parameter, then you choose one moment. If it has two parameters, then you need to choose two independent moments. And I'll tell you in a bit what this means. So
okay,
the first moment is the mean. So it's the average of
yes.
your sample. And the idea is, let's say, in the example of the exponential distribution, so the exponential distribution has if its parameter is lambda, then its mean is 1 over lambda, 1 divided by lambda.
I
and
see.
So the idea is that if you have a sample, you can compute the average of the sample, and you declare that this average should be equal to what the distribution says the mean is, which is 1 over lambda.
Lambda, yeah.
So the average, you set the average equal to 1 over lambda, and that's an equation from which you express lambda. So lambda
now
is
I see. Yeah, yeah.
1
yeah,
over
yeah.
1 divided
yeah.
by the mean.
Yeah, you can solve for it, yeah.
And then that is the estimate
yeah.
for what the parameter of the distribution is. And so in the case of normal distribution, you need two moments because it has two unknown variables. And so you choose the first moment and let's say the second moment, which is the average of the second powers of the variables, of the random variables. Or you can choose something which is independent from the first moment. The first moment is the mean. So something like the variance of the sample variance
sample
is a good variance. Example.
But what is then the second moment? You said the first
second
moment is the mean, and what is the second moment?
So the case moment is the expectation of x to the power of k. So the first moment is the average of x. The
yeah.
second moment is the average of x squared.
Ah, I see. Okay.
Third moment is average of x to the power of 3.
3, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. So this wasn't only the World War II when this was interesting. So if you read the news, if you read business news, today it's a big business that people try to estimate how many Model 3 cars the Tesla company produces.
I see. Yeah,
so
yeah.
they want to figure out how well is it going for the company and how well they are being able to scale up their production.
Not so well from what I've heard from the popular press.
It is an interesting question if you want to invest or speculate in the shares of Tesla. And then the other thing is that, of course, for military purposes, it's very sensitive information how many tanks or aeroplanes you have. So whenever you see images of aeroplanes, they usually have serial numbers painted on it so that you know, like, which
true.
Unit they
yeah,
belong
yeah,
to, and within the unit, which number they are. But these numbers tend to be like very random. So they are never serially numbered, obviously. They just want to mislead anybody who sees the number.
Right? I see, because they know that people could use the German tech problem procedure.
Course.
Yeah,
of course. Yes, and so
that's actually very smart. So let's say smart of them. Wouldn't you agree?
Sure.
If you want to keep that information a secret.
And like, of course, you always want to make information in secret and in a military setting. And so you might wonder how you can defend against this kind of attack. And so you can come up with something like a cryptographically secure pseudonym random number
generator. Yeah.
Or like a cryptographically secure hash function.
That's what I've also read on Wikipedia, yeah.
Okay. There is, shall we make a segue into what is called the doomsday argument?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so the doomsday argument is, again, something a bit out of this world. I mean, you don't necessarily need to take it very seriously, but here is an argument that people make. So, under the assumption of the Copernicus principle, which is that we are not in the center of the universe, we are just an average planet, and you're an average being, you're an average member of the mankind, you could be any member of humanity that has been born and that will be born anytime in the past or in the future. And the fact that you're born now, so in expectation, you should be somehow in the middle of all the people who have ever lived.
True, yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit shaky argument, but let's assume for the sake of argument that this is true. And so what does that mean about the future of mankind? Right, so if you're in the middle,
in terms of what do you mean? In terms of which variable do you mean, like height or weight?
No. In terms of time, in terms of the progress of time, in terms of the serial numbers of humans. Like if each human, when you're born, you're given a serial number according to the time, the moment in which you're born.
You're in the middle.
Then everybody has a unique number, and you're in the middle. Okay. It means that the size of the human population in the future will be as big as how much it has been before you were born, right? So the people who come after you are, on average, or in expectation, the same number as that were living before you.
Before you, yeah.
Okay, and so what does that mean? So you should know, we should know how many people are in the, how many people have lived in the past. And there was one statement that you could hear, which said that, I think it went like this: 2/3 of all the people who have ever lived are alive today.
Okay.
Because somehow there is such a population explosion going on in mankind. That's one thing. And the other thing is that we live longer. And so people don't die as young. We live longer. And therefore, just there are more of us alive because we haven't died, because we live longer.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And so if this statement is true, and I think I might have heard it with half, so like half of the people who have ever lived are alive today.
I know for a fact that the population growth curve is, of course, exponential, and there was this guy Malthus who once argued that, you know, we have, because this is so exponential, and if you look at bacteria, they reach a plateau, and then, you know, they run out of resources, and the same argument was made for humans.
Yes.
But yeah, that doesn't invalidate your point, and I just wanted to make this as a further...
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And so what this means is that if you are alive today, then actually... and so keep in mind the starting assumption of this doomsday argument. So you're at the halfway point in mankind, and 2/3 of the people who have ever lived are alive today, which means that we have a population on this planet of 7.5 billion or something. So, no, let's say 8 billion. So that means that 8 billion are alive today and 4 billion have died in the past. So that's altogether 12 billion people who have ever lived. And so in the future, there will be another 12 billion people. But because we're living at such a high rate, that means that there will be one or two generations of people, and then we run out of people.
Run out of people.
So that means that is this prediction that after one or two generations, we will die out. Because, I mean, if you accept this assumption that we live in the middle, that you are in the middle of these serial numbers, right?
Right.
So that makes you think.
Yeah, yeah.
So the problem is just that this is not true, that we are at 2/3, or that 2/3 of all the people who have ever lived are alive today. So that is just very far from reality. The actual numbers, and I don't know the actual numbers, but the actual numbers is more like people who have ever lived and died is something like 107 billion. So okay. That means that the 7 or 8 billion who are alive currently, it still means that there are another, 100 billion left to live.
Okay.
So that means that there is still plenty of generations of mankind.
To live, yeah.
Of people to come.
Let's hope so, yeah.
Well, let's hope so. Okay. So that was the German tank problem.
That was the German tank problem, yeah.
What brought it to my mind. The next one is that I want to talk about is a method in which is widely used in ecology.
Yeah, that's what I've read. Yeah.
So ecology is getting very important, even here in Germany. This is the study of the biosphere, how many animals there are around us, how many plants.
Also how the many interaction between them. Yeah.
Yes. How the population sizes change over time. So people say that species are disappearing on a massive scale in these past decades across the world.
For example, I remember I heard in a documentary or read that the bees, bees, they are kind of dying out. I mean, this is also kind of ecology.
So people say that about insects. They put out, so that's that method has less to do with statistics, so that's not something that I want to talk about, but I think they put out some kind of traps for insects some decades ago and these days. And they compared the number of how many insects you can catch in a certain type of trap over a certain time interval, so like over 1 or 2 hours, and it's just so much lower now than it used to be. So like half of the insects have vanished, and it's not entirely clear where they went.
Yes, so yes.
Is it? I mean, I think the most plausible explanation is that we're using some kind of pesticides which are killing them off.
Off, yeah.
Okay. However, one method which you can use is called the capture mark recapture, or
I think it's kind of self-explanatory because you capture, let's say, for the example of a bird, you capture the bird, you mark the bird, and then you recapture.
Exactly. So you mark the bird, you put a ring on it. Yeah. The ring has a unique identifier, so some kind of number, and you release the bird.
Yeah.
You wait for some time to allow the animals to mix, so to speak, so that they can travel again, and then you go out again into the field, capture again the same species of birds, and count how many birds have the rings that you've put on them.
I see.
Okay, so let's see an example. So you go out into the field in week one, you capture 10 birds, so you release 10 birds with a certain mark. You go home, 1 week later you come out, you capture 20 birds, and you find that out of these 20 birds, there are 5 carrying the ring that you had put on them a week before.
I see, yeah.
And what is the conclusion from this? So what you see is that 1/4 of the birds carry a ring. You remember that you put rings on 10 birds. So your expectation is that then this unknown population size is 40.
40, yeah.
Right? That's a... straightforward
way, yeah.
Pair of ratios, like you equate two ratios, like the proportion of birds that you put rings on in week one should be the same as the proportion of birds that you capture in week two.
In week two, yeah.
I mean, this assumes, of course, that the population sizes are constant, that birds don't disappear, there's no migration or.
That can,
of course, make things more complicated, or that can throw off your estimation, but under the right circumstances.
Yeah.
Or if your sampling interval is short enough, then it is going to be more true than it is long.
True.
Oh yeah, and the other problem is that animals die, and then you can't capture it if it's died, right? I mean,
yeah, but you're looking at the population, and so individual death doesn't matter at all.
Well, it does matter. In the sense that if you go out in week two and the bird that has had a ring on it has died, then you can't capture that bird as a living bird. Then you would need to be looking for birds that are alive,
which are not doing. Yeah.
So okay. That is a problem. So that means that will throw off your estimation a little.
I see. Yeah.
So if you use more advanced mathematics, then of course you can model all these issues then you can make it more sophisticated. You can refine the model.
We When you say more advanced mathematics, what would spring to your mind? What kind of model would one use there to model that?
I wouldn't say that I have any clear answer. I mean, you have to sit down, look at the formulae, you put in an extra term into the formula and compute with that. And then that makes the computations a little more complicated.
Okay.
That's what I mean. I mean, this is the work of mathematical and statistical modeling.
Yeah,
that you,
true. Yeah.
That you go in and look at it in more detail. You add detail.
Right.
Okay, so let's talk about some applications of this, so that you can see that this thing, although it was developed for, or it is used widely in ecology, it's useful in all kinds of areas of life. So one blog post that I found somewhere is trying to estimate how many Mechanical Turks there are. Do you know what Mechanical Turks are?
Yes, I
so
think I know that.
So it is a service of, I think, Amazon. Yes.
I think it's of Amazon, where you basically outsource work to a Mechanical Turk. Is basically a worker who performs a certain task.
Yeah, so somebody sits in front, some volunteer sits in front of a computer and he clicks on the image.
Well, one can debate if they are volunteers, but let's say
low-paid people who,
yeah.
who have nothing else to do, or yeah. who don't have the level of education with which they could earn more money, or for whatever reason they have to be at home. Okay. And what this group did for this study is that they applied this capture mark recapture model in such a way that they didn't tag people. What they did is that they posted a survey as a task to the Mechanical Turk users, and some people signed up and did the task, some didn't, right?
Yeah.
And they did it like sometime later, let's say a month later. Some people signed up, some didn't.
With the exact same survey?
No, with a different survey, but the exact same people, in such a way that you know who are the people who completed both surveys and who are the people who completed only one or the other, or none of them, right?
Yeah.
And that way you see the sizes of these four populations. So those who were there at the first survey, at the second survey, both surveys, or none of the surveys. And this group actually did this over a longer time period, and the more data you have, the more comparisons you can make.
Sure, yeah.
And just, I just want to point out that, yeah, it works the same way. I mean, you don't have to put rings on birds. It's enough that you somehow identify people, and then you go back into the field sometime later and you identify the same people or the same entities by some kind of conserved tag.
And thereby you can estimate the size of the Mechanical Turk workforce.
Yes, exactly. Which is interesting because
it's so big.
Because you may want to use it, and you're interested in, so if I put out a survey or any kind of task, how many people can I reach? And Amazon doesn't necessarily release this information because it's a business secret for them.
Yes.
and also, you know how much it costs to, let's say, how much you need to pay one person to fill out a survey for you, which takes 10 minutes of the time, and you know how much it costs, and so on. And so you can estimate the turnover for Amazon from this line of business they have, which is, again, a number that they don't want to release. So this is interesting. I just find it fascinating that you can try and
estimate
things
agree.
In non-trivial
ways. But the big
ways.
Question is then, they performed this experiment, and what is the estimate then for the amount of the number of Mechanical Turks?
What is the number? So one thing is the half-life of workers. So they say that the half-life is between 12 and 18 months. So that means that on average, if you start with the population, then 12 or 18 months later, there will only be the half of the original workers
present
in the system. There will be new added, but like there is the turnover. So like the people lost to it, or people who die for the system. So it's like a bird not coming back because the bird has died in the meantime. Okay, so what they say is that they estimated that there are about 2,000 to 5,000 workers available at any given time. And that there are 180,000 distinct workers on the platform altogether.
Wow, okay.
And they also gave estimates for the transaction volume, and the lower bound is $35 million a year, the upper bound is $525 million a year.
Okay.
So this is interesting business intelligence.
Yes, definitely. I completely agree.
So this is from a blog post by Panos Ipeidi. Paidotis.
I will link to it in the in the show notes. What was the name?
BehindTheEnemyLines.com is the blog. BehindTheEnemyLines.com.
I will link to it in the show notes. Yeah, I think it's. I will link to the blog post. Very interesting. Yeah.
Oh, I can send you all the link. I mean, okay, we can talk about this later.
I can make
all the links to all the Wikipedia and whatever pages available to you. Okay. I want to give you two more examples, I think, where you can use the this capture, mark and recapture method. One is a very frivolous one and the other is a very serious issue. Okay, so the frivolous is the following. Imagine that I have a Facebook friend, which is, so this is an actual true story, but anonymously. So I have a popular friend, I have a guy, a friend who's a popular guy, right? So up to a certain point, he had it publicly visible how many friends he had, but beyond a certain point, you could no longer see it.
Yeah, it says something like 1,000K plus or something like that.
So it was over 1,000.
I think there is this feature of Facebook where if you have over a certain amount of people, then it just says more than 1,000 or something like that.
No, it does say it, but you can set it to that. You can keep it a secret, even from your friends. You can keep it a secret from your friends. Who are your friends? Okay. And there was a post by this friend, which was his wedding video, and his wedding video was liked by 302 people. Okay,
yeah.
So that is one number. Another number is that I shared 17 friends with my friend,
okay.
With 17 joint friends. And among those people who liked the video, there were two of our joint friends.
I see, okay.
Okay, so two out of 17 of our joint friends liked the video, and altogether 302 people liked the video. So that is, I mean, again, a case of going out into the field twice and counting numbers and comparing them and identifying who are the people in both sets or in the intersection of the two sets, who are people in only one set or only in the other set.
So you could estimate the amount, the number of his friends.
Yes, that's my argument. So what I'm saying is
that, but you can only do that when you this is when you know about this method that we just discussed, so not everybody can do it.
The method. Yeah. I mean, but there's the point of the podcast, right? We're telling interesting stuff.
Yeah.
So then you can set up this pair of proportions. So 2 relates to 17, like 302 relates to the unknown number of friends. And if you rearrange this, it turns out that this guy has well, that's the estimate. I mean, we don't know how many friends he has, but he has, our estimate is that he has 2,567 friends.
Right. That is perfectly, sounds reasonable to me. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not saying that these are ridiculously accurate, but they give a good ballpark. Like if you remember the Mechanical Turks, like the estimate for the turnover was between $35 and $525 million a year.
True.
So at least it gives you the order of magnitude.
True. Yeah.
Okay. And in any case, so the idea that I want to convey is that in any case, if you have an unknown size population, you might have a good chance of estimating this population if you have 2 independent samples of this population, so 2 orthogonal samples, so to speak, going out to the field 2 times or looking up 2 databases.
True.
And it is also important that the individuals are tagged or like they are marked somehow, so they are identifiable uniquely.
I see. Yeah.
Like the birds are identifiable through their rings, or Mechanical Turks are through whatever identifier they have, or in the case of my friends, it's the joint friends or the identity of the joint friends that we have.
Now that I think of it, the math behind it is actually not that hard to compute, right?
Yes.
So I don't use any kind of fancy algorithms as well. In principle, a lot of people can do that.
Yes, sure. It's a way of thinking more. And of course, this setting up these proportionalities is not a big deal, but I'm pretty sure you can go into like details like... like I said, if you lose from the population, if there are departures from the population, so if people die or disappear, so that's an issue.
Yeah.
Or yeah, I'll come back to that in a bit. So now comes, after the frivolous example of the Facebook friends, now comes the serious example, which is, so you can think of examples like something like estimate crime. So estimate something that some illicit activities or activities which are kept underground, or things that people don't like talking about. So I was in email contact with an ecologist, and she told me in email that she started reading into the subject and she came across a paper where somebody was trying to estimate the number of lesbians in whatever population.
Okay.
Which, I mean, it could be interesting if you're a psychologist or cultural anthropologist or something. If you work for the police, then it might be interesting to try to estimate the number of prostitutes who are active in a certain area. So I'm pretty sure that you could, if you, I mean, think about whether you can find data where people would somehow go out, come into contact with prostitutes and log them using their name, let's say, and try to find two independent data sources like that. So NGOs, charities who try to look after these people, or maybe health clinics where, I don't know, sexually transmitted diseases are screened. I mean, I'm not sure that you would be able to get data out of them, but maybe anonymized. I mean, who knows? Or you... I don't know. But anyway, I mean, if you work for the police and you're a statistician looking into these crime science questions, then you might be able to get access to these. And so I found a TEDx video in this area by Sir Bernard Silverman. So Silverman is a statistician in the United Kingdom, and he also used to be the chief scientific advisor to the British government.
Okay.
And he has a really not long, only 11-minute long video on YouTube, which has only been seen by 820 people or something like that. So it really is not
even
a popular...
Even if it's a TED video, okay?
It's a TED talk. It's a TED independent video where he addresses exactly this problem. So he had the following problem. Modern slavery. So how many slaves are there in the UK? So you would think that slavery is something that has long disappeared.
Yes, I would think that, yeah.
And it's not an issue any longer. But in fact, there are cases when people are forced, where the personal freedom of movement of people has been constrained by somebody else, and they are forced to do some kind of work that they wouldn't want to do. Okay, so he gave some examples for these. So the first example is this. Four men came from the Czech Republic to the UK. I think they were promised some kind of work. They were met by somebody who took their passports away, took them to some squalid living quarters, forced them to work in a factory, and they were forced to hand over their earnings to these guys.
Yeah, that sounds like slavery and a pretty illegal activity.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is example one. Example two. A British girl called Maya was exploited from the age of 12 to 19. So it all started by somebody grooming her. They got her to sell drugs, and then at one point they told her, or started telling her, that she had worked up debt, so she was forced into prostitution to pay off these debts. Horrible things, like she was apparently service up to 30 clients a day. So, well, we don't even want to think about what she went through. A third example is a Vietnamese boy whose family put together $30,000 to be brought into the UK, probably in some illicit way. In the UK, he was forced to work on a cannabis farm, from which he managed to escape, but he was recaptured. And then he was put into a situation where he suffered from domestic and sexual abuse. So these things, these stories happen around us. At least in the UK, there is no reason to believe that they don't happen in Germany, where we are speaking. And Professor Silverman also brought up as example nail bars, car washing, or supply chains. So when you buy something where it's produced, how it's brought here. How do you know that there were no, forced labor?
You have no chance, yeah, yeah.
Or child labor, or things like that. And so he started working on this problem. The problem is, he was asked to try to estimate the number of slaves in the UK, these modern time slaves. He said that there was something called the National Referral Mechanism, which was operated by the National Crime Agency, which produces reports about this question. And this report said that in 2013, they knew about, or they estimated that there were 2,744 victims of modern day slavery. So 2,700 is what they thought. Now the problem is that this is a hidden crime. So these people are such that if they escape, they may not be identified, they may not consider themselves slaves, or they may not report it because of shame, or because how they ended up in this situation is, as it all started by doing something illegal in the first place.
Yes, I can see that, yeah.
And therefore, this is a missing data. So the problem is, it's missing data. The data is never complete. You might say that this is a hidden population problem. You want to estimate the size of the population again. This is the same thing as the catch and mark recapture, right? So try to get you into this way of thinking. And what then he said is that the National Crime Agency had five data sources. One was lists from the police. Second was governmental organizations like the Border Control had data on this. There are charities like the Salvation Army who come into contact with such people. There is the general public, and there are local authorities who may collect information.
But the general public doesn't put them in some sort of ordered database or something.
So I don't exactly know what he meant by that, okay? You should look at the video, or
yeah.
I'm pretty sure he published some paper on this, and I'm sure that it's well documented somewhere if you look for it long enough. And so what this is now is that you have five captures from the same population with numbers, and he can then start comparing which individuals come up in which surveys of the population. And so there are five surveys which gives you 31 categories, to 2 to the power of 5 minus 1. So whoever appeared in one of them is 2 to the power of 5 minus 1. And he then tried to estimate the total number, which is the 30.
Okay.
Second number. So people who haven't appeared in any of these surveys. And he came up with the result that, as opposed to the 2,700 that people thought are out there, his estimation said the number was between 10,000 and 13,000.
People. Oh, wow. Okay.
So how much more is that? It's about five times, well, not quite five times more, but between four and five times more than
how it's about, much
the authorities.
Between four and five times, like you said, more
and
than...
And he could only come up with this because of using some clever statistics. I think it might have been his own research to be able to fuse these five data sources.
I see.
And he was looking at data that everybody had, it's just that people didn't know how to combine them, or that it was possible to combine
them. Yeah, I see.
Okay. And he said that this is good for at least two reasons. One is that by exposing the size of the problem, more attention is directed to it.
I agree,
larger problem. And then it helps you allocate resources to tackle the problem.
But tackling the problem is still kind of hard.
It is still hard, but you know how big it is. And of course, police is always, resource bound, so they always have to make decisions which crimes to follow up and which not.
True.
So it is useful for them. Okay.
There it is.
This is the video. It's not very spectacular to watch, but it is interesting.
We will link to it in the show notes.
Yes, sure. And so this brings us to another question, which is, like I said, this mark and the recapture process works under certain conditions. One is that your population should be closed, so there should be no individuals going missing. And the other is that there should be no selection bias. So it means that when you capture birds, let's say on your second field trip, then you should be equally likely, it should be equally likely for any bird to be captured. And it is, if let's say the ring makes birds behave differently and it's easier to spot birds which have the ring because they don't fly so high or something.
I see, then
that,
yeah.
Of course,
that's a problem.
Well, misleads your statistical estimation.
I wanted to say that this selection bias isn't a problem, but the argument that you just mentioned makes sense. Yeah, and it could be a problem. Yeah, because so one could think that kept or marked birds fly lower than non-marked birds, for example, and this might lead to a selection bias.
I don't even want to give any particular example. I mean, I don't think that birds which have a ring are unhealthy or...
No. That's not what I said, but it could lead to selection bias, like you said.
Yeah, so there could be subtleties that you're just not aware of. Or like you go out in different time of the day. And so if you do the first survey in the early morning and the second survey late in the afternoon, then it might be a different population that you're actually sampling. So that could be an issue.
That is true, yeah.
Okay.
And although I have to, sorry that I come back, but I have to disagree with you here, because birds don't really have a time lifestyle like humans have. Like I don't think that they...
I'm just shrugging my shoulders. Right, sure. I mean, I'm not saying that this is the best argument that I can come up with, but if you're thinking of all the examples that we've come up with, like the Facebook friends, like maybe the Facebook friends that I share with this friend are less likely or more likely to like a wedding video, right? So that can introduce some kind of selection bias. So selection bias is something to keep in mind. Anyway, that's the point I'm making here. Yeah. And with that, I want to tie on to a different question.
Yes.
Again, going back to World War II and the Allies trying to do statistical work to be able to optimize the battlefield.
The battlefield.
Or whatever. Operations.
I already see a picture of a plane with bullet marks, I assume. I've heard about this problem, and I'm very looking forward to now getting to know this.
Okay, so this is a very famous graph of, how do you call it? It's a directional view of an aeroplane from above, a two-engine allied plane with red bullet marks on it. And this data was captured by looking at planes that came back from the battlefield. So bombers that dropped their bombs or didn't have the time to drop their bombs, they were shot at by anti-aircraft artillery or by fighter jets from the Axis powers, and they came home, landed, and people drew or logged, recorded where they had bullet holes.
Yes.
Okay, and the question was then, okay, so we have the data, and do you want to describe this, or like what do you see?
Yes, we can see, like you said, an airplane that has several round bullet points, and these are basically where the plane was shot.
Yes.
And it seems to be on the wing of the airplane. They are evenly distributed, I would argue, and say. Yeah.
Okay, so they are basically concentrated on four locations. So two of them are the wingtips, or the outer sides of the wing. One is on the fuselage, so that's the long cylindrical main body of the airplane, and one is the tail of the plane. Interestingly, we don't see bullet holes, let's say at halfway on the wings, and we don't see bullet holes on the engines.
Yes, that is indeed interesting, yeah.
And so people said, okay, what do we do then? What do we infer from this? And so the majority opinion was, by the Center for Naval Analysis, which was, you know, a body stuck with scientists, with statisticians, is that, so if you have the plane with bullet holes, then we should just reinforce the plane at the point where they get the most bullets, right?
Yes, one could actually infer that if you're hit in the engines, then you might not survive, the plane might not survive it and come back.
Okay, so you're getting at why the argument is wrong. So the first argument was that you just look at the data and you say that, oh, planes get too many hits here and there, so we should enforce them. What you're pointing out very correctly is that what about the planes that didn't come back, right? So those that came back were actually the lucky ones.
Yes, yes.
And those that didn't come back suffered the heavier damage.
Yes.
Which prevented them from coming back. And this was an observation by the actually Hungarian-born statistician Abraham Wald.
Abraham Wald, very famous guy.
Abraham, yeah. He came from the currently Romanian city of Cluj.
Cluj, yeah.
Used to belong to Hungary back then.
I think Wald is also famous for a whole statistical testing framework,
yes,
right?
Yes. And so he said the exact opposite. He said that what we should focus on are the planes that didn't make it back, and reinforce those parts of the plane which don't get bullet, I mean, which don't have the bullet holes in our data, because if the plane gets hit in those places, it seems that it doesn't make it back. And so that means that exactly it's the engines that you should reinforce, for instance.
Yes.
Yes. Which is like very logical in hindsight, right?
Yeah.
But that is a prime example. It's an excellent example about what is called the survivorship bias, which is one form of sampling bias. Okay. So this is something to keep in mind. What you see in your data is not necessarily representative of the whole population. It might be true in any kind when you make sampling. So if you're in economics, it is also important for you. So let's say, here is the question: How much money does the average startup founder make through starting the startup, right? Through funding that company. And the trouble is, I mean, the easy way to collect data is you go out, look at the startups, you compute some average and present it as the data. Trouble is that you only look at surviving startups, right?
That's the first part.
Most of them,
and also the startups that are willing to give you data.
Well, okay. Sure, but to be pedagogical, that's not what but that is also biased, sure. But the point is that I'm trying to make here with the survivorship bias is that if certain members of the population die out and don't return data, then,
yes,
then that biases your sample.
True, yeah.
And you have to keep that in mind. Another quite mind-boggling idea which ties into this is that selection bias is not necessarily always bad. It just depends on what you want to achieve, right? So this is an interesting thought experiment that I'm going to say. I don't know whether it has ever been realized or not. The idea is that imagine there is an infectious disease and we have a vaccine against it, but we don't have many vaccines, only a few. And we want to vaccinate the population as efficiently as possible. So that we want to vaccinate those people who are most worth being vaccinated against the disease, against the spreading disease. And one way of defining who these people are might be to say that those people who have the most social connections should be the people vaccinated, because they are the most sociable, so they meet the most people. So if they catch the disease, they will spread it to the most people. So these are the points that you want
to
push down or prevent from getting the disease in the first place.
The nodes in the graph that are mostly
connected.
Yeah,
so the nodes in the social network, in the graph of social contacts. Trouble is, how do you know who these people are?
Yes.
You don't know. And so one suggestion is that you do the following. You hand out randomly vaccines. Like, you pick as many people in the population, how many of these injections you have. You give them the injection and you tell them the following instruction. Instead of giving the vaccine to yourself, hand it to one of your friends, and your friends should vaccinate themselves with it. Now, assuming that people are altruistic and they don't just vaccinate themselves because they are afraid of the disease, but they actually follow the advice, what you then achieve with this is that those people who have a large social circle are more likely to be given a vaccine from the general population than those people who have few social connections. and thereby you achieve
kind of.
I mean, you bias your method towards that direction that people with many social contexts will be more likely.
But like you said, in this context, it would be a good thing. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It would be even better if you were to say, give it to your friend and say to this person that the other person should give it to their friends. That should have introduced two steps. Then it would even further increase the probability that the person is a high, I call them now social hub. Input graph, high hub. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Giving vaccination, handing it out in the population and advising people to, instead of vaccinating themselves, giving it to one of their friends and asking the friend to vaccinate themselves.
Yes, yes.
And the idea is that with this method, you're more likely to...
And my question was, if we have a two-step process, then we get even better hubs.
Okay, so my concern is that I actually don't know what is the instruction when one person gets two vaccines. So who should they hand it out, right? So if you have two friends who are giving you a vaccine, then you are not supposed to give both vaccines to yourself.
Yes, okay, true.
So, but I mean, you should pass it on. And somehow that's my conjecture, that if you did it in two steps, then you might end up with more people having multiple vaccines.
Yes, yes, I see. True, yeah.
But then, okay, so that's a technicality, so to speak, that doesn't take away from the beauty of the idea.
The idea, yeah, true.
And I really don't know whether it has ever been used or not.
Why? But it seems to be like a good idea. I mean, maybe you should tell the minister, health minister.
No, I mean, this is well known among epidemiologists.
Okay.
And there are actually diseases where people are developing a vaccine and there is just not the production scale, right? So there are two issues. One of them is that they are experimental, so we're not 100% sure that they are actually, or we don't know how efficient they are. And the other is that because we don't know how efficient they are, there is no reason, not much reason to invest the money to build out the production facilities.
I see, yeah.
And so there are smaller runs. And so two things that come to my mind. One is Ebola. I don't even know whether we have any kind of vaccine against Ebola. I think
I can chip in there. There is actually just a little nerd talk. It's not my area of expertise by any means, but I once read that they now succeeded in actually. First, of course, there was basic research into a vaccination, and they. My last information is that they succeeded now in a vaccination, but I assume, like you said, the production process right now, as of right now, might be very complicated and such that they wouldn't roll it out on a massive scale, but people in risk areas and so on. I just know that there now is one for Ebola.
Okay, yeah. I think I heard about malaria. So like malaria is a notoriously hard disease to beat because it's just such a complicated life cycle what the pathogens have. And I think I might have heard that there are some vaccines with low efficacy rate, but anyway, so they could try it out with these. And I think against the Zika virus, which...
I know for a fact that in tuberculosis you have some very nice work, or not nice working, but you have working vaccines that are there, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So again, it points out, it's just interesting to see how statistics and abstract thinking can help in very tangible,
definitely, yeah.
everyday issues.
In public health, or in
areas of...
People sitting in ministries who are listening to this podcast. Yeah, I'm not kidding you right now, because there are people listening all over the world, and this seems like a good idea to me.
Okay, I think we're done with the survivorship bias now and sampling issues. And I would like to continue with the third and last subject that I brought today.
Yeah.
Which is, again, something meant to estimate the number of something unknown.
This is the topic of today, estimation. Yes. Let's put it under estimation.
Yes. Well, estimation from very sparse, very scarce data. And this is the Fermi problem. And what the Fermi
isn't
problem
like led... we just said, sorry for interrupting, but estimation from sparse data seems to be the whole the whole scheme or the whole topic of statistics. I mean, you're everywhere concerned with you have a population, you draw a random sample out of that population, and you want to infer population parameters and want to say something about the population.
That's true, but what I think what I'm focusing on today is estimating the population size.
Size, true. Yeah.
Somehow in statistics, that's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing or the question that they ask is that given that we have a statistical model for something, we want to find out what the parameters are which you know put life into this model so that we can simulate it, we can compute with it.
Also predict stuff.
And predict stuff. Yes, and so the total population size is not necessarily something that you need to figure out. Often you actually know it, right? I'm trying to bring subjects where we have no clue what the total population size is. And we want to get a ballpark estimate from ridiculous or disconnected or seemingly disconnected data points.
For example, what I'm thinking of is this scheme that I just brought up. If you think of like sociologists doing market research, you know, they have this idea of calling up people, like picking up a phone and call, and there you actually have a huge bias, because who is willing to talk to you? You don't get like people who are maybe stressed out, so you're getting a specific subpopulation that may not be representative of the population you want to generalize to.
And the demographics are also an issue, but I think they try to correct for as much as
possible.
So the Fermi problem and the Drake equation are the next subjects I want to talk about. It goes back to conversations with Enrico Fermi, I think.
Was it an Italian physicist?
Italian physicist, 1930s, United States immigrant. I'm sure he worked on
the Manhattan Project.
Yes. And the question was, so are there aliens? And if there are, so like, is it likely that life exists elsewhere in the universe? Is there extraterrestrial intelligence? And if there is...
These are actually different questions. The question is questions. There life or is there intelligent life?
Yes, sure. These are different questions. Or to put it another way, I mean, if you don't believe in God, if you think that the world just came to existence and due to natural processes, humans arose and we developed intelligence and civilization, then how likely or how unlikely it is that this can happen elsewhere? And if it can happen, then it should have happened like everywhere. There should be millions and billions of planets with civilizations on them.
Because the universe is so vast.
And if you continue thinking, like we have done some bit of space exploration. So we had flown to the moon, you know. Again, tying back to the starting argument with the serial numbers of tanks, German tank problem, or the doomsday argument, that we are probably an average developed society or civilization. So if there are many civilizations, then some should be like extremely advanced in comparison to us. Yes. And that means that they should be able to travel in the space.
Yes.
So where are they? So have they visited us? Are they around the Earth? And if not, then why not?
Why not?
Or if yes, then why don't we see them?
True.
And so the question is then, how many civilizations are there in the world? Like how many extraterrestrial civilizations are there? How many places are there in the world with intelligent life forms? Okay. Another thing, which is like the complete opposite of this highbrow discussion, which is an everyday situation you might end up in, is that you go to a job interview, and they want to test how intelligent you are or how you think, and they ask the question, how many petrol stations are there in the capital of the country, wherever you are? So like in Berlin, how would you approach this problem? Like you basically have no clue, but there is somebody sitting across the desk trying to figure out how you think.
Yeah.
What kind of argument you can come up with. And so there is a standard way of answering this question, and I'll tell you what the standard way is, right? I mean, people, the HR people or the hiring managers or the manager who is looking for a new employee usually has this in mind, has one particular way of solving this in mind, and this particular way is basically the Fermi problem. And it goes something like this. So let's say we're talking about the capital of your country, which means that you know the population of the capital, which, like, Berlin was the population of
3 million. 3 million,
that's very good. Okay, that's what I thought. So you know there are 3 million people in Berlin, so what proportion of the population would have a car? And if you have a car, how much do you drive? And if you drive, how much is the fuel consumption of your car? How big is the fuel tank? How often do you have to go to refuel it? Like, how many times in a month? So, like, what is the time interval between two refueling? And once you do that, like, question is how many petrol stations can live off of that kind of market? So you may look at it from a more a business perspective, like, what is the turnover that, you know, a fuel station produces by selling fuel, and what is the turnover that you need to be able to hire that many, to employ that many people who work at the petrol station. So the population of car drivers, how many petrol stations can they keep in business? So you can approach this problem like that.
Yes.
Or I think that's what most people do. So look at the turnovers, like, how many euros do you pay at the station? How much is their profit margin? How much they have to pay to their employees? And how much does the land cost for them? Maybe another way to look at it, it's just a slight detail is, again, the point is you don't have any information. You don't have any data. Everything you do is guesswork. So one thing you can think of is, like, when you picture in your mind an average petrol station, like, how many pumps are there and how many cars are at a petrol station at a given time, and how long does it take to refuel a car? And so from that you can estimate, like, this time distribution of time that the pumps are occupied or not occupied, how many pumps are at the petrol station, how many are usually occupied. And so if you know how many car drivers there are and how much fuel is used, and you know how much on average, how much is the occupancy rate of petrol station from your memory, then you might have a guess at the number of petrol stations.
The number of petrol station, right, yeah.
And that's a different way of approaching it from, it's not looking at the turnover, but something else. But the idea is the same, that you take numbers such that those are factors in a big product, like many factors, such that if you multiply them together, then you get a number,
yeah.
Like a big number.
Yeah.
And the idea here is that, so why on earth are we doing this? Maybe there are two more examples. Okay, let me explain then another classical example, which is on the Wikipedia page of the Fermi problem. This formulation is apparently attributed to Fermi himself. The question is, how many piano tuners are there in Chicago? How many people have the occupation that they tune pianos?
Pianos, yeah.
And
yeah.
Live in Chicago, Illinois, United States. And so, again, this is pure guesswork. So you might say that there are about 9 million people living in the Chicago area, metropolitan area. On average, there are two people in each household in Chicago. One household in 20 has a piano that is tuned regularly. Those pianos that are tuned regularly are tuned on average about once every year. It takes a piano tuner about 2 hours to tune a piano, including traveling to the location. And each piano tuner works 8 hours in a day, 5 days in a week, 50 weeks in a year. These are all guesses, right, or guesstimates.
Yeah.
And then you can multiply these all together, and what the page says is that there are 225,000 piano tunings happening in a year in Chicago, which may or may not be true, and one piano tuner can tune 1,000 pianos in a year, so that gives you that there is a market for 225 piano tuners if they work like full-time and that's the only thing they do as their profession. And apparently in 2009, so of course Fermi lived in, asked this question in the 1930s or 40s, but in 2009, apparently the actual number of piano tuners was about 290. So the estimation gave 225, the real number is apparently 290. So that's how good this is. Let me explain to you what the Drake equation is, because it ties
into this. I've also read that the Drake equation was criticized because in the product, the factors are so conjectured. Okay. They're very conjecture based.
We'll come back to that in a moment. That I think I will tie up with that one. So the Drake equation is again an answer in the same manner to the question of how many civilizations are there in the galaxy. Okay, so capital N is the unknown that you want to estimate, is the number of civilization in our galaxy with which communication might be possible. So radio communication or whatever, or they travel here. Okay, and again we break down this number into a long product of actually 7 factors, and the idea is that each of these 7 factors you may or may not be able to estimate it, but because those are somehow more tangible problems, you might be better at estimating them. And the other thing is statistics. So there is a statistical reason, which we come back to in a moment. And so the factorization, which is in the Drake equation, is the following. So they say that you need to take the following numbers. So you take the average rate of star formation in the galaxy. That's number one. The second number is the fraction of those stars that have planets. The third one is the average number of planets that can potentially support life per star that has planets. The fourth one is the fraction of planets that could support life that actually develops life at some point. The fifth one is the fraction of planets with life that go on to develop intelligent life. The sixth one is the fraction of civilizations that develop some technology that releases detectable signals into space. So something that we can see from our distance. And the last 7th factor is the length of time for which such civilizations release detectable signals into space. And you're absolutely right. So these are 7 numbers which are not necessarily easier to estimate. Some of them are actually very tangible research questions for astrophysics, like average rate of star formation, or what fraction of stars have planets, or what fraction of planets are in this livable zone. What is that called? Livable? No.
Habitable zone.
Habitable zone, thank you. And right, so, but are we any closer to solving the problem, or are we not any closer? You might rightly ask. And that is where statistics comes in. So one thing to do here is, instead of looking at a number that arose as a product of many factors, you can take the logarithm of this, because you want to estimate anyway a positive number. So you're allowed to take the logarithm of both sides of this equation.
Yes.
Now the logarithm of a factor of a product of 7 terms becomes the sum of the 7 logarithms of the 7 factors,
yes.
Right? Because that's a property of logarithm, that it turns products into sums of the logs. And now you have a sum, which is actually very reminiscent of what is an average, right? I mean, average over the 7 terms is just a question. I mean, you can divide both sides by 7 in the Drake equation.
Yes,
it doesn't make
yes.
any difference, really. And the idea here is that even if you can't estimate very well the single factors, you might be able to guess the order of magnitude. And if you can assume that your estimates are unbiased, so that you're likely to, I mean, your estimate will have an error, but if the expectation of the error is 0, so you're equally likely to overestimate as you're likely to underestimate
it, yeah.
Then these errors have a tendency of cancelling out.
Yes.
So by turning one estimation problem into, let's say, 7 independent estimation problems, in each of which you're not any more accurate than you were originally, because your estimates will have a tendency of equaling the errors out, you will actually get a better estimate.
Okay.
So that is the whole idea why you would want to do this. So you can see this as a random walk where steps up are like estimates where you overestimate something, steps down are estimates where you underestimate
something.
Or the other way around, it doesn't matter. And we know a lot about the distribution of such sums. So we have something called the, you know, all of the heavy machinery or theoretical results of probability theory. So the law of large numbers, strong law of large numbers, or the central limit theorem. So they say, so the law of large numbers says basically that if you have a independent numbers like the terms in this sum, so numbers are independent and identically distributed, which is not the case here. Then, if you take a large sample and you take the average of that sample, then this average is going to converge to the mean of the distribution, so the actual average value of the population.
True.
So it's like if you want to estimate how tall the German people are, then you can go out and measure somebody, and then you get one number which is going to be off of the average because you will catch a very short or very tall person with high probability. But if you measure 10 people, or if you measure 100 people, or 1,000 people, and take the average of these measurements, then that will
converge towards the true mean.
To what is the true mean. And the idea here could be the same thing. So if you do this factorization in your Drake equation, or in estimating the number of piano tuners or petrol stations, if you can assume that you can increase the number of terms, and you assume that you are able to so you are able to give an unbiased estimate for each of them individually, and also you should factorize them really in such a way that each of them come from the same distribution, so each of them should have the same expectation
let's say,
at the minimum. So the answer to, let's go back to the piano tuner, so the number of I don't even know. Number of persons per household should be the same as the number of households per piano, should be the same as number of how many pianos you tune in a year, or something like that. So if that condition held, which obviously doesn't hold, but under the ideal case scenario, that would be the point why this method works. Because you take the sum of many terms, each of which in an ideal case would have the same distribution, and you take the average of them, so you take five terms. The product of five terms gives the unknown population size, or the product of nine terms gives the unknown population size. As long as these terms are basically on the same order of magnitude, then you can reasonably hope that your estimate would be better than if you just went out and tried to estimate the whole population size in one go.
Yeah, okay.
And so you're absolutely right. So that's the Drake equation. That's also how to estimate the number of civilizations in the accessible universe, in the galaxy. You know, we have no idea what the number is because we don't see any, but you might reasonably expect to be able to estimate how many planets form around suns, and how many are there in the habitable zone, and how many will have, you know, organic molecules in sufficient quantities, and so on.
True.
So forth.
I mean, one counter argument. I mean, yeah, I agree. One could guess that in a way, but one could also argue, yeah, maybe there are intelligent life forms out there, but they wanna actually hide because
that is not taken into account,
and maybe they have the advanced technology.
Maybe you can
to
just
hide.
Add it as a factor. I mean, sure. Like, yeah, we had a factor. What is the proportion of them that emit signals which are detectable where we are? The fraction of civilization that develop a technology that releases detectable signals. And when you have this counter argument that maybe they hide, then I just decrease this factor.
True. Yeah.
And I mean, it is still an estimate, and we still can't really. I mean, the problem, of course, is that you can't verify it because that's the only estimate we have. But with the number of piano tuners, we saw that actually it corresponds to reality.
It works, yeah, true.
you can't expect any of these three methods that I talked about to be accurate.
Sure. But
they should give you a ballpark or an order of magnitude, which can be extremely useful, or can be actually just interesting to think about.
Definitely, yeah. And it is because then this when one fills that out, one gets a large number of possible intelligent life forms, and that creates a paradoxon, because why, yeah, like you said, why don't we see them, why are they not here? And one possible reason could be that they're hiding, actually, and are so intelligent to be able to do that. Yeah, I mean, regarding that, I mean, I also find those questions kind of interesting, and I'm agnostic in this regard. Of course, one cannot know if there is life forms out there. Yeah, I always also differentiate between, like we said, between like simple life forms that is easier for me to imagine, like some sort of bacteria living off of on Mars or somewhere like that, and then intelligent life forms. The question is also, do they have to be necessarily DNA based? Is that, or I mean, the current theory to how life evolved here on planet Earth seems to be that you have RNA, that you had RNA molecules. They sort of ended up self-catalyzing or auto-catalyzing it, and then somehow getting into or transcribing into DNA. And then, of course, we are now DNA based, but it's the current hypothesis is that the RNA world hypothesis, where RNAs auto-catalyzed themselves. So that would also be an interesting question, whether life forms of different planets could be non-nucleic acid based. My suspicion, but that is just a hint of mine, is that they could not be, but I to be honest, I don't know. Also, I mean, biologists debate whether viruses, for example, the HIV virus, live. I mean, they replicate, but they don't have, like, also they have kind of a metabolism, but what is the fourth thing that one needs? They're certainly not conscious, and not also not animals show instinctive behavior and so on. But yeah, that's
What I want to add to this is that, so the statistical problem that I talked about is called the Fermi problem, and there is the Fermi paradox, which is exactly this question. So where are they?
I see.
And there is a very good blog entry which collects all kinds of ideas around this in one blog post. I think it's the Wait But Why blog.
Wait, but yeah, I've heard of
a long essay. I've heard of this, that. All the questions, like, is it likely that we as a civilization, if we are unique, is it possible that we are unique? And if it is, or is it that we have gone through some kind of bottleneck, so we were lucky to survive some kind of bottleneck, or is there a bottleneck that we are about to hit? So it is in our future, and that is where I mean, civilizations don't come through, and that is why we don't meet them.
One could argue that with the whole climate change, one sees the at least the possibility that mankind actually gets extinguished.
That is true. But ever since we have nuclear weapons, there has been the option that maybe it will be a third world war that wipes out mankind.
But at least with nuclear weapons, I don't want to digress too far. But that I have to say, I mean, I always see you cannot possibly if you use a nuclear weapon. The detonation is not such that every square meter of, for example, a continent like Europe or Asia is hit by this by the detonation, and people will not die immediately.
Sure,
and,
but the question is how many nuclear weapons you use. I mean,
yeah, but I don't see the possibility for complete extinction. There might be some mutants surviving and
okay.
My point is,
it's an interesting question, interesting thought experiment. Yeah, I think it's the blog is, I think, the Wait But Why blog. Wait. And there is a whole long blog entry about the Fermi paradox, and it's fascinating, I think, to read on a, you know, long winter evening.
That is certainly true. In the end of the blogcast, I like to ask my guests, so did you ever know that you want to become a mathematician, or when manifested that fact?
Did you back in school, around the age of 16 to 18, I specifically applied. I knew I was training myself. So the reason was I was reading books about cosmology, so Roger Penrose, Stephen Hawking books about Big Bang and these fascinating questions of cosmology, how did the world arise? And back then I was thinking of either applying to study mathematics or physics, and with a bit of what should I say, hubris, I thought you can always start with mathematics and you can add physics later. And of course, I've never quite done the adding a bit of theoretical physics to it. But yeah, I think there was this So that's what caught my attention. That's what fascinated me back then. And I was simply a talented pupil in my class, and I thought that I can give it a shot and see whether it works out to study pure science for the sake of it.
So already,
and if it doesn't work out, then there is still something else I can do later on.
that's certainly true. So already with 16 years, I think that's very, very good, yeah, very interesting. And then the second and now last question for the podcast is, can you recommend to people other podcasts, or maybe also in the last episode, some publications that you enjoy reading, for example, like magazines and so on, or also
read my blog.
Millikuti.me, by the way.
I'm not joking. The thing is that I don't really follow popular science, either blogs or podcasts or YouTube channels and stuff like that. So I'm really not the best person to recommend anything. Hear about some from my friends, but I'm just not well informed in this area.
No problem, but we will link your blog in the show notes. And thank you very much, Bence.
Thank you, Philip, for having me. Yeah, it was really interesting to read into all these subjects, which really not my expertise, but it was interesting to dive into it and make myself a bit more knowledgeable about them. Thank you.
For me also, thank you very much.